Do not let your heart be troubled. You trust God, Jesus says. Trust in me too. We've been on this great journey. How do you live with an untroubled heart in a troubled world? Take a moment again. Let go of whatever troubles you've been carrying around. Reflect. How much trouble in my world, scale of 1 to 10 over the last 24 hours? And how much peace in my heart, last 24 hours, scale of 1 to 10? And if you want, we're doing a survey to measure the impact. Find out, can we really learn this stuff together on a journey like this one? And I'd love you to fill that out if that would be a helpful thing to you. And I want to say a few more words as we end this journey together and then give you kind of a fun parable about how to live with an untroubled heart in a world that's full of troubles, large and small. First, I do want to say thanks. Just got back from Amarillo. I preached at a church there with my buddies, Murray and Howard and other folks. Nance was there speaking. I met with the B12 class. That stands for the Bible and the 12 Steps. And they put together kind of a cool resource. They were actually part of, as the church was, me putting that book together, as a lot of you were. Thank you so much. Everybody that read, encouraged, wrote a review online, contributed. We're actually going to film a video curriculum for that in a couple weeks. I'm going to be in Chicago very shortly doing a seminar and preaching on it. But they put this together. We admitted, we came to believe, we made a decision, we admitted to God, ourselves, and others, the Bible and 12 steps that leads to a self-surrendered, cross-shaped life. And the warmth and the welcome and the power, the raw honesty in that room, with that group of folks, B12, you guys, way to go. I'm so grateful to you and everybody who's been part of that journey. And now I want to talk for a couple of moments about living with an untroubled heart in a troubled world. By way of reminder, Jesus says we can do this because our future is in his hands. I'm going to go prepare a place for you, he says, that, and then I'll take you with me so that where I am, you'll be there forever. And he reminds us that we know what God is like now because we know Jesus. And he makes these remarkable invitations. Ask whatever you will in my name as you're seeking to live out the life of God's kingdom and God's love. And he says, my peace I give to you. And I've said these things that my joy might be in you. Just remarkable statements. And now at the end of the passage that we're looking at, this is in chapter 15, he's been telling the disciples that he's now going to call them not his servants, but his friends. And then as an enormous encouragement, he says this, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Church is still going 2,000 years later. And so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my command. Love each other. Now, to understand Jesus' relationship with his disciples, a lot of folks have written about this. You have to realize that Jesus was a rabbi. He was a teacher and shared a lot of practices with other rabbis in that day. But a scholar by the name of Kostenberger writes, one of the ways in which Jesus was different from other rabbis was this. It was standard rabbinic practice that if you wanted to be somebody's disciple, you went to them, you applied to them. It's kind of like when I graduated from East High School, Harvard was not coming around Rockford East High School saying, please come to us. But this is why Jesus says what he does here at the end of this passage we've been looking at. In his case, it's quite different. You didn't choose me. I chose you. This is a humbling thing for a rabbi to do, to go out there. And he's doing it to people that nobody else was trying to go after. Fishermen and IRS guy and somebody that would have been regarded as a terrorist. But it was kind of a reminder. Now, Jesus is transcending the relationship of a rabbi and the students. Students would abide with the rabbi to learn from them. But now Jesus is going to be crucified and then he's going to be resurrected. So his invitation, abide with me. I'm in the Father, the Father's in me. You abide with me and my words will abide with you and I will make my home in you. See, this is that relationship, only instead of just abiding with Jesus physically, they were going to abide in Jesus spiritually and he was going to live in them. And that's going to happen for you and me. And that's what enables us to live with an untroubled heart in a troubled world. And this is, to me, a kind of a parable in this that I like. It was written a long time ago by a guy named Robert Fulghum, who was a pastor and an author, and it's about a wedding that is deeply troubled. The central figure in this drama was the mother of the bride, not the bride of the groom or the minister. Mother, usually a polite, reasonable, intelligent, sane human being, mother was mentally unhinged by the announcement of her daughter's betrothal. I don't mean she was unhappy, as is often the case. To the contrary, she was overcome with joy and just about succeeded in overcoming everybody else with her joy before the dust settled. Nobody knew it, but this lady had been waiting with a script for a production that would have met with Steven Spielberg's approval. A royal wedding fit for a princess bride. Since it was her money, it was hard to say no. The father of the bride began to pray for an elopement. His prayers were not to be answered. She had 7 months to work, and no detail was left to chance or human error. Everything that could be engraved was engraved. There were teas and showers and dinners. The bride and groom I met with only 3 times. The mother of the bride called me weekly and was in my office as often as the cleaning lady. The caterer called to ask me if this was really a wedding or an invasion he was involved in. Invasion, I told him. An 18-piece brass and wind ensemble was engaged. The church organ was too churchy. The bride's desires for home furnishings were registered in stores as far east as New York and far south as Atlanta. Not only were the bridesmaids' outfits made to order, but the tuxedos for the groom and his men were bought. Not rented, mind you, bought. If all that wasn't enough, the engagement ring was returned to the jeweler for a larger stone, quietly subsidized by the mother of the bride. When I say the lady came unhinged, I mean unhinged. Looking back, it seems now that the rehearsal and dinner on the evening before the great event were not unlike what took place in Napoleon's camp the night before Waterloo. Nothing had been left to chance. Nothing could prevent a victory on the coming day. Nobody would ever forget this wedding, just as nobody ever forgot Waterloo, for the same reason, as it turned out. We all live in this illusion of control. I can manage everything. I can control everything. Not so much. The juggernaut of fate rolled down the road. The final hour came. Guests in formal attire packed the church. Enough candles were lit to bring daylight back to the evening. In the choir loft, the orchestra gushed great music. And the mighty mother of the bride coasted down the aisle with the grandeur of an opera diva at a premiere performance. Never did the mother of a bride take her seat with more satisfaction. She glowed, beamed, smiled, and sighed. She'd done it. The music softened. 9 chiffon-draped bridesmaid lockstepped down the long aisle, while the befrocked groom and his men marched stolidly into place. Finally, oh, finally, the wedding march thundered from the orchestra. Here comes the bride. Preceded by 4 enthusiastic mini-princesses, chunking flower petals, 2 dwarfish ring-bearers, 1 for each ring, the congregation rose and turned in anticipation. Ah, the bride. She had been dressed for hours, if not days. No adrenaline was left in her body. Left alone with her father in the reception hall of the church while the march and the maidens went on and on, she had walked along the tables laden with gourmet goodies and absent-mindedly sampled first the little pink and yellow and green mints, then the silver bowls of mixed nuts. She ate the pecans, followed by a cheese ball or two, some black olives, a handful of glazed almonds, a little sausage with a frilly toothpick in it, a couple of shrimp blanketed in bacon, a cracker piled with liver pate to wash this down, a glass of pink champagne. Her father gave it to her to calm her nerves. What you noticed as the bride stood in the doorway was not a dress, but her face, white. For what was coming down the aisle was a living grenade with the pin pulled out. The bride threw up. Just as she walked by her mother. And by threw up, I don't mean a polite little lady like erp into her handkerchief. She puked. There's no nice word for it. She hosed the front of the chancel, hitting 2 bridesmaids, the groom, a ring bearer, and me. I'm quite sure of the details. We have it all on videotape. 3 cameras worth. The mother of the bride had thought of everything. Having disgorged her hors d'oeuvre champagne and the last of her dignity, the bride went limp into her father's arms, while the groom sat on the floor where he had been standing, too stunned to function, and the mother of the bride fainted, slumping over in ragdoll disarray. We had a fire drill then and there, in front of the church, that only the Marx Brothers could have topped. Groomsmen rushed about heroically. Many princess flower girls squalled. Bridesmaids sobbed. People with weak stomachs headed for the exits. All the while, unaware, the orchestra played on. The bride had not only come, she was gone into some other state of consciousness. The smell of fresh wretch drifted across the church and mixed with the smell of guttering candles. Napoleon and Waterloo came back to mind. Only two people were seen smiling. One was the mother of the groom, and the other was the father of the bride. What do we do? Well, we came back to real life. People changed clothes. The bride was consoled, cleaned, fitted up with a bridesmaid's dress, hugged and kissed a lot by the revived groom. She will always love him for that. When he said, for better or for worse, he meant it. If one can hope for a wedding that it will be memorable, then theirs was a raging success. Nobody who was there will ever forget it. And then he writes about how the best part is years and years later, they gathered the wedding party back together again, and they replayed the ceremony all over again. The event was hilarious, especially with running commentary and the stop-action material that's a little gross when seen one frame at a time. The part that got cheers and toasts was when the camera focused on the grin on the face of the father of the bride as he contemplates his wife as she's being revived. And the reason I say that is the best part is not because of the party, but because of who organized it. Of course, the infamous mother of the bride. She's still at it, but she's a lot looser these days. She not only forgave her husband and everybody else for their part of the debacle, but she forgave herself. And nobody laughed harder at the film than she. And there's a word for what sparks that kind of joy, and it's love. It's just love. The reason that you can live with an untroubled heart in a troubled world is the promise that at the end of everything, says in the book of Revelation chapter 22, the Spirit and the bride say, come. Let all who hear say, come. Let the one who is thirsty come and take the water of life without price. God says that the joy that lies before you and me is something like the joy that will happen in a great wedding. And in this world, a lot will go wrong. In whatever event happens, a lot will go wrong in my day-to-day, and a lot there will be trouble in this world, and some of it is stuff that we'll be able to laugh at. It was my birthday recently, and we were going to have steaks, but when I went out to Grills Nancy's Steak a little bit more, the dog ate my birthday steak. And sometimes it doesn't take much, you know, to get in the way of an untroubled heart, and then sometimes there's enormously deep loss and pain. I know. But our friend Jesus says, don't let your heart be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. This is the invitation to life in a troubled world with an untroubled heart.
Hey, before you click off, go ahead and hit the subscribe button to our YouTube channel. That'll help us reach more folks. Become New is dedicated to growing spiritually one day at a time, and we do that through brief teachings each weekday. So if you subscribe, you won't miss any future episodes, and we'd love to hear from you. So you can chime in the comments here, or if you're not a part of our Facebook group, right now we're doing something interesting. I'm posting a video there each day to correspond with the video that's released here, with a question that you can engage with, and I'd love to have you add your voice to that conversation. So you can find the link to that Facebook group in the description below. You can also find the link to follow us on Instagram or X, where we post regular inspirational posts throughout the week to encourage you in your spiritual growth journey. If you have a prayer request, there's a group of us who meet each weekday to pray for viewers just like yourself. So be sure to not carry that burden alone. We would love to come alongside you. You can text your request to the number 855-888-0444 or email it to us at connect@becomenew.com. Remember, the most important thing about your life is the person you become. We'll see you next time.